So first of all, I want to welcome everyone. This is our inaugural podcast for speechscience.org, which is very, very exciting. I have a colleague of mine here with me, Ivan Campos, who's taking the lead on a lot of the multiculturalism issues and diversity issues. And then we're thrilled to have with us today Mike Skattis, who is responsible for recruitment for the American Speech Language Hearing Association. We're just really honored to have you here, Mike. This is a heck of a way to... I'm so glad you say that, because this is a heck of a way to kick off our first podcast. And, you know, it's due in no small part to your efforts and the change that you've been able to enact that we're even here talking today. So I appreciate all that. So, Mr. Skattis, I guess we didn't really talk about this question very much, but I wanted to ask you a little bit about what you've perceived as impact, I guess, in the last 6 months. Like, you know, we had for the first time the sort of male recruitment booth at the conference. We've had heightened sort of, visibility, on the internet, certainly in terms of men and minorities. Do you feel like you've seen some traction?
We do feel like we've seen some traction. We feel like there's a buzz around what we're trying to do, so we're excited about that. From a big picture, we know that when we're trying to recruit an underrepresented population, such as men right now, that this type of change is going to take a while to really have an impact and a change that we can say we've taken credit for.
Okay.
As far as how many men are in the profession. And that's because we've seen when we've recruited individuals from underrepresented racial and ethnic populations,
right,
as well as recruited more bilingual service providers, we knew that we had to build interest among those different communities. We had to provide information and resources for them. We had to build a pipeline of those people coming into the profession and into ASHA. And we had to sustain those who were in that pipeline. And you know, we knew that that recruitment effort, that type of recruitment, would mean that we need at least 2 to 5 years to increase males' awareness of the discipline. What are the benefits of being a speech language pathologist or an audiologist? And that's going to be followed by another 2 to 5 years of building that pipeline of males in training to
right.
come into these professions, and you know, about 5 to 10 years concurrently to influence any major changes in the amount of men that we see in the professions. That said, that we could really take credit for from this, we have seen the number of men in the professions increasing who are in the first few years of ASHA membership. So that number is trending upwards, which is a positive for the entire effort.
Great. So then I guess a follow-up question I would have is why? Like, why is this even a priority for ASHA? Why has this become a goal?
That's a great question. And we know that having a more diverse membership and a more diverse profession, it's going to be more engaged, a more empowered profession, more willing to innovate, more willing to speak up and take risks and make their needs known to develop an innovative solution to help move the profession forward. So we also know that increased diversity among the service providers is going to be linked to improved outcomes
right.
and lessons in healthcare and
right.
Reducing educational disparities and things along those lines. We know that greater diversity can result in, from an ASHA perspective, in an organization that's better able to serve a diverse set of members.
Right.
And that if we have a more diverse set of members, we know that they will be better able to serve a more diverse constituent base. And all of that, results in members who are more loyal, people who are looking to ASHA first for products, services, and resources to help them serve those diverse communities that they're now reaching out to.
Great.
And the reason why, reaching out to men right now is such a key part of this is we're making some real inroads in other areas. But we don't believe we can have a truly diverse and inclusive membership with the existing gender imbalance.
So tell me about those inroads. What are some successes that we could celebrate? Not even related to this, but just in Asha in general.
Absolutely. The amount of bilingual service providers
that's great.
Our Asha members has continually been increasing. I've got the numbers on my whiteboard right here. We've got 11,759 bilingual service providers who are Asha members. And we think there are a lot more people out there who are bilingual service providers.
Who aren't self-reporting.
Just educating people.
Because what is that? That
education will get more people in.
I was wondering, Mike, could you explain the process to becoming a bilingual service provider with Asha? Is that something that is a self-identify, or is there a certification for that?
That's a good question, Ivan, and there's multiple layers to that answer as well. At this time, it's a simple process for an Asha member. They can go online, identify. As you mentioned, they can self-identify as a bilingual service provider, and then they will be seen on a public tool such as Profind to different clients and patients, alerting the public that they are a bilingual service provider. Part of the strategic objectives that we are working on right now are to really find some transformative ways to improve these different the workings of the bilingual service providers and the other diverse communities. So we're exploring language proficiency and trying to identify how we should best be measuring that to prove that there is an ability to deliver service in multiple languages. We do have an ad hoc task force right now that is exploring the feasibility of bilingual service provision and the language proficiency is part of that overall overall effort, and that's something that won't be happening anytime soon, but I believe in the next year or two we'll have some guidelines on what we really should be looking to have as a minimum requirement for bilingual service provision.
So it sounds like Asha is open to considering, you know, a process of creating a certification process for bilingual providers, correct?
We're looking at a credential level, I think, would be the first step. It could possibly tie into certification. There's a lot of different options out there, but yes, we are looking at some way to set a standard for bilingual service provision so that the public can say, I feel confident knowing that this person can not only speak two languages, but they can really understand each language at a level that'll help them deliver service.
Well, and I can say, as you know, first of all, and I made this joke to you earlier, it's really bizarre to be a white heterosexual male that's in the minority, right, in a profession. It's taken some getting used to. I will say that working in elementary schools, the restroom is my own personal kingdom, which is you know, kind of nice. And until you're at the Asha conventions, and then you have to hike for a while. You know, I'm very often, like, I tend to work in high SES, either high SES or very, very low SES situations as a result of living right on the cusp of rural Oregon. And, you know, I've been asked to perform assessments in Native American languages, in Spanish, in Russian, in Somali. And, you know, I have not felt ethical, I guess, doing that. But I haven't had a resource that I can turn to that's normed or in that for that population, or that I can, I mean, I've got the MOCA, I guess, you know, that's available, but that's not appropriate for, I don't know what the point of my sharing this is, except to say that I agree with your priority. You know, I think that that falls into the bigger picture of drawing people into the profession, right? You know, I mean, you just made
good. No, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you just made a comment that 8,000 SLPs have identified as bilingual, you know, and based on the most recent numbers from Asha, that constitutes 5%, which is 2% higher than men, right? So that's a victory, but it's one that still needs to grow.
Correct. And I think we're at 11,759, so we're closer to 7%.
Okay, all right, maybe I misheard. All right.
Okay.
But yes, it definitely needs to grow. It definitely needs to grow.
And, okay.
For the reasons you mentioned. Additionally, it's a complicated issue because if a child needs services from a bilingual service provider, but none's available, would it be better to have someone who could, as you were mentioning, speak some of the language to try to make a connection? I don't know the answer to that, but that's something that I think is going to be explored, and the research done on that to see what would be the best way to deliver the best service
right.
to ASHA's clients and patients.
Right. Well, and optimistically, I would say, and I'm sorry, Ivan, I keep talking, but I would say I would make a wager to say that the quantity of bilingual professionals in the U.S. is right. going to rise in the next 20 years.
Absolutely.
You know, I think with this direction of providing or considering a credential with bilingual speakers or speakers of other languages, I think this is really a good, going to provide a good service to our clients in terms of making sure that those speech language pathologists or audiologists are truly qualified in assessing in that language. Because many times there are, you know, assessments that are being done and you know, by an English speaking SLP that is using maybe an interpreter, you know, and sometimes interpreters lack the training to understand the nuances of our profession, to understand what we're really asking clients. You know, and so there's that issue of, should we be relying on interpreters, you know, to assist us in, you know, doing these evaluations? And at the same time, if we're self-identifying and not really having that expertise in that language, are we doing a service or a disservice to the profession, you know?
Right.
So I'm glad that there's embarking on this, you know, looking into this issue of quality versus quantity in terms of assessing people in their home languages. So this is, you know, great news.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ivan.
Yeah. That's fantastic. I mean, and that's going to make my life a lot easier, frankly, as a clinician. And I think it's also going to contribute very positively to something that we know is a major problem in school districts, which is the overdiagnosis on a massive scale of communication disorders among L2 English speakers. You know, what's interesting for me about this is that, like, my Spanish is really very poor. Like, I mean, and doing hearing screenings is maybe the funniest part, because I'll say something, and you're going to laugh at this, Ivan. I'll be like, lever su mano cuando beep, you know, like, I kind of don't know what I'm doing. But, you know, I mean, I've lived in parts of Southeast Africa, you know, I've lived in Russia, I've lived in Western Europe. Like, I have these other skill sets, but we don't get immigrants as often from those communities, right? You know, I mean, we have a large Hispanic community. Here we have a large Somali community. You know, I know one Arabic provider. So, again, I'm getting a little bit tangential here, but, you know, I guess once again, I'm voicing support. You know, that's one thing that I really like about your role, Mike, is that when you look at recruitment, you know, it's not just about growing the profession, but it's about growing the profession in a way that's, you know, going to ethically serve the clients that we see, right? You know, which is both, I think, enormous responsibility, but also a privilege.
Absolutely. It's a big privilege to be able to work for this profession and be able to recruit people that we've identified would help with the diversity of the profession. And it's one of those things where if we have more diverse members, we'll learn more, we'll learn from each other. Everybody will improve their services. It's one of those, you know, a rising tide raises all ships type of environment where if we can bring in more diversity, everybody will learn more and everybody will be able to serve those clients and patients more. So it's a benefit for everybody.
Yeah, right. There's no downside whatsoever. Well, and so that brings up, if you're ready to segue, that does bring me to another question here. You know, one of the questions that we have on our list that we wanted to ask here was how are students choosing these careers? Like, I know a lot of people that look into SLP and then end up going into OT or something like that. Like, what do you think motivates that, and how can we help?
Well, we know from our research that when someone is looking to choose a career or choose a major, The first issue that they're looking for is interest in the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're looking for competitive salary and benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Number three is job security. And number four is that personal experience. And that piece really, I think, plays a big role in a lot of the stories that we've seen with how our members got into the professions, how people get into speech-language pathology and audiology. Often you'll hear, my father had a stroke, or my mother couldn't hear very well, or they have stories about their grandparents or
right.
their siblings.
Precisely.
And they have that kind of personal connection to these professions. And that really drives people towards being a speech-language pathologist or an audiologist.
Right.
Looking at the responses that were heavier for men, job security was number one.
Okay.
And there was another interesting piece was number two was that their friend was majoring in a major, not just speech-language pathology, but in any major. Men seem to follow their friends more into careers. And that there was a parent who worked in the, or a family member who worked in the field. So those really were bigger with men than with women. And that kind of leads us to a possible strategy for, you know, how we might be able to recruit more men into the professions. We've got a lot of resources that we're putting out right now, but you know, understanding that, how are we promoting that this is a great profession with great job security?
Right.
How are we sharing that message? So that's something we're looking at.
Right.
You know, there's also men are more likely to enter a CFP profession because of the challenge of the profession.
Right.
That appeals to people, and the nature of the work also appeals to men. So maybe we push those pieces forward.
Right.
It is a challenge. You can really push yourself in this profession and talk about the nature of the work. Of you know, there's a lot of different settings, a lot of different environments where you can use these skills to have a career, from working with children to working with adults to working to people who are retired and elder adults. There's a lot of different people you can work with. You can work in schools. You can work in healthcare settings, on and on and on. So promoting that, I think, is another way to really help promote these professions to men.
Yeah, I had a clinical supervisor tell me once that it's one of the best professions because you can have six or eight midlife crises. And continue. Now, do you find that there's a disparity in gender in different sort of placements or settings? Like, do we see more men in medical, for example, or school, or do you have that data?
We have a little bit of that data. I can tell you that the speech-language pathology profession is at about 3.7% right now with men.
That's better. Okay.
Where audiology is closer to 17%. So that's where we've really seen the disparity.
Okay.
I haven't seen that much of a disparity in healthcare or school, that type of setting. That doesn't mean it's not there. I just haven't seen that.
You know, Mike, you mentioned that ESHA's undertaking some strategies to diversify membership.
Right.
And could you share some of those with us? I mean, if you're privy to, or?
Absolutely. We've got a number of things we're trying to do right now. And some of the more exciting ones, I think we've targeted different high schools. So schools that have a STEM focus
right now.
And that have a diversity of over 75%. And we would love to be able to reach out to all high schools, but you know, one, we don't have the resources for that. And two, I don't think that would really impact a more diverse membership the way that identifying these schools where there is that STEM focus and they do have a diversity of over 75% in those schools. So we can look at schools that have 75% male students, schools that have 75% African-American students, schools that have 75% and over Hispanic students, Native American, Pacific, Asian Pacific Islander, any of these groups that we have out here, we can identify those people and then target our communications to them. We have a lot of resources that talk about the professions, but there are ways to tailor those communications that would really be more impactful to the people who are in these different diverse segments, and communicate with them in a new way and identify them in a new way to really share the professions and what's going on. So that's something we're really excited about. I think that's going to be a big push for us this year.
Do you, this is pretty much, you would be sending materials, I guess, to guidance counselors at schools? Is that something along
Correct.
The lines of, okay. And
Correct.
Sure
we'd be trying to connect with those guidance. I'm sorry, go ahead, Ivan.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, you're correct. We would be reaching out to connect with those guidance counselors, and we would be sending them materials, everything from brochures to career kits to links to different videos online. And we've got different stand-up exhibits that we can send out to people so that they can use those at different career fairs. In addition to that, we've worked with people who are in all of those local settings and recruited them to come in and represent the professions at the different career fairs that the schools are having. So working with those guidance counselors is a great way to do it. And then working with the local people who are there and can make a real impact.
Right.
One of the things we were mentioning and why the students choose a career was that a friend was majoring in it, or a parent or a family member was working in the field, and having someone who is a mentor, I think you mentioned the same thing, Lucas, having someone who is a mentor that helps you move into that profession really resonates strongly with men.
Right.
So I think if we can get that grassroots network of working with those local guidance counselors, using the materials that we are creating for these diverse individuals, then we can really make an impact.
I think that's a very good point. I mean, I wouldn't have done a bachelor's in computer science stuff if it wasn't for a great mentor. I wouldn't have gotten a master's in linguistics if I didn't want to chase a girl that was in that program. And then, I wouldn't have gone into SLP if I didn't have a family impact. So like you say, I think people do these things for a reason. Now, one conversation that we've had extensively, so we're here talking to you sort of in two different capacities. So Ivan and I, really, I think we could say with some confidence are the two that are sort of leading this initiative in terms of the podcasts and, trying to get this information out. And so there's two different things that are happening, right? There's the speechscience.org website, which really is intended as a resource for new clinicians, for students, for paraprofessionals, for educators, for people who don't have the time to sit and read primary research, right? So it's a way for them to learn new skills. So far we've got an overwhelming response to that, which is fantastic. And then the other capacity in which we are speaking to you is as, sort of some of the founders of this surprisingly successful Facebook men's group. Really surprisingly successful. People were joking the other day that I think what was it? I think we've got something like 10% of the men in there now.
I think it's close to 600 now.
Yeah. Right. Well, I think we're almost at 700. Granted, not, these are often, they're often SLTs, from Ireland or whatever it might be.
There's literally people there from all over the world.
Oh yeah. We've got Namibia. We've got, we had somebody who worked at McMurdo Station. I mean, it's fascinating. It's an incredible group. And in fact, anybody who's listening to this who is a man, come look us up, as long as you're nice. There's a few things we don't put up with, and one of them is misogyny.
I'd say that you identify as male and you're welcome to join.
Yeah, fair, absolutely. So,
amazing success, Lucas. That's some really amazing success there. What actions have you done to build on this community for men that has really been growing like crazy?
That's a really good question. Let me back up for one moment and just share the thought that I had in my mind based on what you said, which was that we have been hypothesizing in the group about reaching out to our alma maters and offering to Skype in, just maybe even for 20 minutes into these classrooms, into a high school, and give a presentation about what we do, maybe with a case study and some cool information. And that's something that we collectively, you know, could marshal 100 or more people to do. So just so that's on your radar, that would be, I think, a pretty efficient way to reach a lot of people. So that's that. So the second piece about the group, well, you know, what's funny about that is it sort of started as a goof for me. You know, I was in a graduate cohort of 34, five of which were men, which was high, and I think still maybe is high. So it sort of became this running gag, and so we created this group, I created the group and then brought these folks in. And then as I started to work in the field, then I would invite any male coworkers to join. And suddenly we had maybe 100, 150 people in there. And what we found is that it wasn't like what I was really expecting was a lot of the like, oh, I hate white elephant parties and stuff like that. You know, I was expecting it to be a very male oriented, but really, and Ivan, I don't know if you disagree. Are you guys still there? It looks like I lost you.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm here.
I'm still here.
All right. Yeah. What it's almost become is more of a, I mean, it's more of a, like a hardcore clinical support group, right? Like, I mean, we have some pretty intense conversations about complex dysphagia issues. We had a very complex conversation recently about Gilbert syndrome, which is, you know, vanishingly rare. You know, and I've gotten better information, I think, often from that than I do from the larger groups. And I think it's partially that the function of, you know, if you're in a car accident, you're supposed to point at one person and say, call 911, because everyone else is just going to stand there. You know, with a group like this, I think everybody has a vested interest in making sure the community is vibrant. We go out of our way to make sure that people feel honored and respected in that way. We will recognize contributions. We will give people roles as moderators and administrators when they do good things. You know, and then we also allow them to highlight their own achievements. So it's a very celebratory community. I wouldn't say that, you know, we do occasionally get, you know, like there was a gentleman who shared recently an experience that I've had too, where a teacher asked him to keep their door open while they were working with a student. And it was a gender-based sort of complaint, you know. And that was, you know, unfortunate to hear, but it did start a very interesting conversation where we all sort of talked about the ways, because I've been in a similar situation. And my solution to it, which I still do, is that I audio record every single session, you know, with union permission and these sorts of things. So it's, you know, it's about finding these things. And I think a lot of these liability questions apply to women just as much as they do to men. So I'd say we were probably up at 300 and some odd folks. And then we got real whimsical at Asha and handed out the cards, which you saw. So we had these... you know, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen cards, which were very, I thought they were pretty classy. It felt like a special invite. And,
they were great.
Yeah, it's worked out well. We're out of them. They're all gone. I got to think of something new for this year. So that was successful to the point that, we not only did we run out, but I've had to mail them all over the country. And then we've had people that have taken even further initiative, folks that I didn't even expect to do it. Like somebody's been making these decals of it that go on the inside of your windshield or wherever, you know, the back ear. I had no idea that he was going to do that. But I've provided all the art that I created for free at very high resolution. So I don't care. Do whatever you want. You know, we've talked about the concept of having a ribbon at Asha. Yes, Ivan, sorry.
I would say another contribution of the group that we seem to be getting students who are in bachelor's degrees programs.
Very much.
In speech language pathology, and they're asking questions about the field. You know, they're asking questions about how do I get into grad school? You know, what grad school would be best appropriate for me?
Right.
We're getting young males interested already in the profession as, you know, undergrads, trying to figure out what's the best, and also career advice.
Right.
Many times students who just graduated from a grad program are asking about contract questions or asking about work settings. So it's more than just the league, you know, in the sense of a business card, but it's a community of, I think, of a thriving community of individuals that want to support each other and contribute to the betterhood of, you know, the profession that we're in, speech language pathology. So
yeah, that's a very, very good point you make, because probably about a third of the posts we get are, can you proofread my resume? You know, do you know any professors at this school? You know, I have this interest. Is this the right place for me? You know, and sometimes I'll get those messages just personally, and I'll say, you know, you really should ask the rest of the team. And then just recently, who had to leave the call, Chandru, the reason why he's been involved with this so much is he's the one who convinced me to restart the speech science program. And Ivan, you might have been around long enough, or even Mike, but back 2002 through 2004, every month I would write a blog called This Month in Speech Science. And I would read all the articles that I felt qualified to analyze, so basically not dysphagia and neurology. And I would write, you know, here's what they studied, here were the people they studied, here's the impact for you as a clinician, here's the impact for you as a parent. It was like a paragraph. And we got a lot of traffic from that. But what I thought was most interesting is that Chandru sent me an email recently and said, hey, I just got into grad school and I got a lab position because of what you wrote in 2004. Because I was interested in the topic after that. And that really had a profound professional impact on me. Because I don't think there's anybody who's in SLP. Like, I'm not expecting, I don't know of any SLP billionaires, right? Or millionaires. Maybe contract agency owners. I don't know. But that's not my motivation, right? I mean, this is a service profession. And, you know, whether my name is remembered is not the issue. But what I do want to do is I want to help new professionals, you know, find their way. And if that way is going OT, then great. But I want to at least know that they understand what it is that we do, how profoundly we can impact the lives of others, and frankly, how wide the scope of our practice is, you know? Okay, that was another monologue. I'm going to be quiet again.
No, that'd be great.
That'd be great, the being quiet? Okay.
No, being quiet. The vision that you were sharing there, I think, is a great one.
Mike, do we think we adequately answered your question?
I think you answered the question very well. Very well, thank you.
Okay. Well, we have a few questions to ask you if you have a few more moments.
Yeah, I got a few more minutes.
Okay. So, and this was sort of collaboratively, and you know, Ivan, maybe you should take the lead on some of this, because a lot of this was your idea. But you know, we also, did you want to go ahead and do that?
Go ahead, and then I'll tag along.
What's trade off? So I'll take one from a different member here. So, you know, a lot of us, I think probably all SLPs are members of a lot of different groups, whether that's Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or whatever it might be. And one thing that we've seen, particularly in the last 2 years, is a lot of negative affect around ASHA for a variety of reasons. Like, there's a group that's called something like ASHA Members for Change, and a lot of it goes back to, Ivan, what you were discussing, in the sense that we've got, you know, special certifications for what? Child language disorders, fluency, speech, swallowing, and then there's one for audiology, right? So there are people who really strongly say, like, well, you shouldn't be working in AAC if you don't know AAC, or you shouldn't be working in X if you don't know X. So I've gotten that piece, and then I've also gotten just feedback basically from a licensing standpoint that there isn't enough control placed on the different state standards of how that would look. I don't really know what the question is here necessarily. I just wanted to share that that's there, and I'm curious if you've heard that or if there's any strategy in place.
Well, as a membership organization, we hear from our members on everything that's going great and on the things that aren't going all
I imagine,
well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, all of it is very valuable feedback. We need all of that feedback to improve what we're doing as an organization. We're listening to the members in social media through the communications that they have with us. Through, you know, they're calling us on the phone every day. They're emailing every day. Some have issues that we can take care of right away, which
great.
We do. We've got a great team here that's trained on making sure that when a member calls up with a question, we're going to find the answer for them and get them the best resource or connected to the right person or get them signed up for the different program or product that they're looking for. There are times when members call up and they are looking for something that we don't have right now.
Right.
We listen to that information, and we're always looking to improve. And that type of complaints or concern type of call are really some of the most valuable calls we get.
Oh, sure.
Tells us what we need to improve on and what we, we know we're doing a good job, but we also know that we could be doing a better job in other areas. So that really helps us improve. And that's our goal, is to constantly be improving to better serve the members so that the members can better serve their patients and clients.
Okay. That was a great answer. That's probably a question. I know in the next few weeks, we're also going to be talking to Perry Flynn. I'll probably ask a similar question. I imagine I'll get the same answer. But it's something that I've personally been curious about, because I'm just surprised. Like, I haven't, I've never had a negative experience with Asha. There was one person on social media that I disagreed with that I won't name, but it's resolved. these things happen, and to catch that so thoroughly. But one thing that I will say, I'll probably mention this to Perry, and maybe you have a comment, and again, then I'll be quiet, and Ivan, it's your turn. I feel like as a discipline, a lot of what we do, especially in graduate school, is very wide but shallow, if that makes any sense.
Could you explain that a little bit more to me?
Okay. So in the sense that you receive a very broad survey of what the discipline can entail without really diving into it. And this has just been my experience. I know that there are other universities that are different.
Wide to shallow. Yes, I understand.
Right. Now, as a clinician, I would say that I'm narrow and deep, which has its own set of problems. But, I wonder if there's a way, and maybe this is through certification, maybe this is through partnering with even like Resna or something, I don't know what it is, but, finding a way to assess clinician knowledge outside of essentially the praxis and the practicum. So I don't know, again, if there's an answer, but that's something maybe the head of SIG, maybe Carol Zangari will hear this podcast and think about it or somebody. I don't know.
We do have the CFCC, which is, making sure that they're holding the standards for the profession at a very high level.
Yep.
And, they do that to protect the integrity of the professions, and then they show that the public can have a lot of confidence in someone who has the C's behind their name. Additionally, there are specialty certifications through ASHA that will let the public know that that person is an expertise in one of those different four or five different categories right now. So there are discussions on making sure that people are held to a very high standard, and that's something that I know the CFCC really strives to do at a high level.
Yeah, and I can see for the two states in which I'm licensed, certainly Washington and Oregon, there is a very high standard of accountability. Certainly, I personally have gotten, I think, 3 phone calls from the licensing agency, none of which were actually issues at all, but just for due diligence, which is great. Right. I appreciate that. And it helps to clarify the rules, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, it's just sort of a general question that I've had. Part of it is born out of being an AAC person and, walking into a school a few months ago and having, a close to retirement SLP, tell me that she felt like it was a professional liability to admit that she didn't know anything about AAC, which scared me a bit. And that was the genesis of the creation of a lot of the materials that I've created, because I feel like if I can create an anonymous way for people to grow their knowledge, then maybe that would be more desirable even than CEUs. And so I can't help but think that that exists in other areas. So go ahead.
You know, look, mm-hmm. I think that the issue that you bring up kind of segues into the, I guess, the topic I want to bring up, if you don't mind.
Sure, please, please, please.
So, you know, we're thinking here about culturally and increasingly culturally and linguistically diverse population, which the United States has become. And so, you know, pair SLPs at the graduate level perhaps require specific coursework or clinical hours with diverse populations. And in addition to that, what Lucas was speaking about is, what about practicing SLPs and audiologists? Should there be a requirement that they participate in continuing education courses about serving diverse populations? You know, that's something that, as a minority working in the field, and also, you know, that many times we come across, you know, monolingual and speech language pathologists who have limited information due to their training about linguistically diverse populations. And, you know, once you leave grad school, you're pretty much, you know, the amount of information that is going to flow at you at that tidal wave rate has decreased, you know, significantly. And so you're left to pretty much continue education on your own. And so I'm just wondering, should there be a requirement in grad school, at the graduate school level, that students, again, you know, take a coursework in serving diverse populations? And also for practicing SLPs, should they be required to partake in these courses? And I guess that's my question, is how is ASHA meeting that bridge or meeting that requirement, I guess?
That's a great question. And it's something that we're looking at with the increase, the diversity of the membership efforts that we're doing. That's one of our strategic objectives as an organization. And we have 8 strategic objectives on our strategic pathway to excellence. And one of those strategic objectives is increase members' cultural confidence. And we have, what you were just talking about, we recognize that that is occurring. We recognize that there's a shift in the demographics of the United States, really around the world, but in the United States, which is our focus. We know that from 1980, there were somewhere in 30-some million households, people were speaking multiple languages. We know that's up almost to 60 million in 2010 and growing. We know that the Hispanic population is increasing. The Asian population is increasing at an even greater rate. So we know that these issues are out there. This is a new objective for us, increasing members' cultural competence. So it's something we're exploring right now. It's something we're excited about as an organization. And we hope to have something concrete in the next few years as far as direction on what we're going to do to help make those changes.
Great. Great. That's great to hear. I know that I was just trying to remember her name. Complaint. Yeah, the person who's in charge of continuing ed.
Oh.
Hold on, I can find it. I swear I can find it. Well, it doesn't matter. Anyway, you know,
Continuing education for ASHA?
For ASHA, yes.
Were you looking at Chris Urena or Ellen Fagan?
Ellen Fagan was the person I've communicated with. And so she's on our list, our growing list of people that have tentatively sort of confirmed that they would like to speak to us. And, you know, one thing that I would like to suggest, and I don't know how realistic this is or how contracts work with the various CEU providers, but I think it would be great if people were limited to taking a certain number of CEU credits within each discipline, sub-discipline per year, you know, and I'm fully guilty of that. You know, I tend to focus on the things that I'm passionate about, but it would be great to learn more about, you know, myofascial disorders or whatever it might be.
Cross-disciplinary learning would be fantastic.
Yep.
And we've seen that in some of our programming with the case studies, for example. We had a case study on audiology, and the speech-language pathologists were very active in picking that program. Additionally, the audiologists have been very active in taking some of the speech language pathology case study programs. So we see that among the membership, and that there are people out there actively looking to have a broader knowledge base is something that we support.
Right. Good.
Real quick question. So, you know, ASHA 2017 is in November in Los Angeles, California, my hometown. So I'm wondering, are there any plans for another Mayo recruitment center?
Right now, we don't have a plan for a Mayo recruitment center. What we are thinking about doing is having a mentor connection for men, where, you know, we might even call it a mentoring or a mentoring or something along those lines.
I like that.
But having a way for people who are established in the profession, such as you two, or at least in the community, who everybody knows, to serve as a mentor and really welcome some of the men who are new to the profession or new to ASHA or who are still students, and really show them the ropes. So the thinking would be we make these mentor connections for our convention. Someone would, the mentor would make a connection with the mentee, and they'd have a conversation, agree to meet up somewhere in LA, somewhere for the convention, introduce that person to some of your colleagues, and then have a follow-up afterwards. So it would be something that I think ASHA can help make some connections there, and we would be relying on the very active community that you've both been talking about to help really bring some of those new members in.
That's it. Wonderful. Yeah.
Made prior to ASHA, or is all the involvement there at the ASHA convention?
The thinking would be that there would be three steps, that whoever was the mentor would contact the other person prior to convention, introduce themselves, talk a little bit about their background and their expertise, and then meet somewhere during convention for that face-to-face connection, and then have some kind of follow-up afterwards. And it would be a pretty relaxed type of connection. We wouldn't, you know, make people do anything as far as fill out too many forms or things like that. It would really just be a, would you like to be a mentor? Would you like to be a mentee? Maybe pair somebody up by geographic region or some of the data that we already have, but not really have too much of a pull. Just
or
understand
interest area, even
to make that connection and help facilitate it.
Yeah.
Really based around their experience at convention and you know, the prior at and a quick follow up afterwards. If they make a great match and want to continue on with that relationship, we would fully support that. That would be great.
The way it kind of sounds like a way to make the convention less threatening to men, because at least you know at least one person there before showing up, you know?
Well, I think there's also some value in having somebody who really has gone through the muck, so to speak, you know? You know, and like for in my position, you know, I'm an SLP, but I'm also, you know, have been a private practice owner, and I'm an entrepreneur and these things, and finding people like that that have those common interests, I think would be very, very useful. So you know what, I'll just stick to one last question, which is obviously we have a pretty vibrant community. We have what's amazingly become kind of a strong brand, and I'm referring specifically to the men's group. But I also want to ask you about the speech science piece. And so the questions I have are twofold. First of all, how can we support what you are doing? And I know we've had this conversation before, but in case you have any new ideas or specifics or even just generalities. And number two is that I have the aspiration, as do many of the people that are in the group, to somehow represent ASHA in some way. And I know that that's challenging, given a variety of branding issues and everything else. But I'm curious if you think that either of things are a possibility and how we could move in that direction.
Well, I certainly think that both of the organizations can support each other in this effort. We've talked about having links to each other's website on each other's websites. One of the pieces that we've developed with the help of the community at convention was we've got a lot of feedback for a microsite, so we're going to be developing that that's really designed to help recruit men.
Great.
Something that will have more of a rugged feel to it and an inclusive feel that's really going to help men connect with the professions and tell them what these professions are all about. So feedback on that, being active in any community that we have there would be fantastic. And we certainly want to be part of your community, which, as you've mentioned, is growing and vibrant and bringing more men in all the time. So
right.
That's great as far as the how we can partner with each other. And then, I'm sorry, what was the second part of the question?
Well, before I move on, I just want to say that I agree with you, and the only caveat I would place on that is that I think that what we've created has a pretty distinct sort of culture and identity, and so I would want to, as much as possible, preserve that, even if that means that we do have a backlink, but not necessarily, integrate the things. We do have a microsite for our current initiative that we're happy to unleash to you or make more of a NASA initiative or do your own thing, whatever. I suspect you're all intelligent people. You certainly sound like it. So you can figure it out.
That culture that you've created. It's a great culture and people love it. So,
well, and it has,
don't let us.
Yeah, I really have to emphasize it's got nothing to do with me. We just have amazing people in there, all I've done is written a set of rules and started the thing. So, but it's people like Evan and we have Jonathan and we have a team of 11 admins and they're amazing. So, the second question is about the speechscience.org thing. So, we have really, we have a lot of informational websites as well as vendors that are on board to support us. Now, there's ethical things that I'm unwilling to do. For example, I'm not going to have banner ads on there for vendor products. I'm potentially okay with that, doing that for contracting agencies, things like that. But the critical piece of this entire website is that it's going to be something that is based on the most current evidence that is cited, and is something that is a resource that is put in plain enough language for people to understand. And I can get on a soapbox about this to some extent, but even within the world of speech pathology, you're looking at a minimum of 6 years of higher education plus a CF plus a journal access subscription to even have access to the evidence that you need. And if you have a child with a new autism spectrum diagnosis and you start to Google what that means, it's an absolute minefield of horrors, right?
We can all learn from each other, and yeah, I think there's lots of ways we can work together. You mentioned that you've got some conversations set up with ASHA Continuing Education and looking at how you can really connect there, and I think that's a great way to make the right connection with ASHA when you've got all that education that you're looking to develop. Yeah, if we can, we're following each other on social media, so if nothing less, we'd be able to promote those through our channels. But yeah,
cool.
I think there's a lot of ways we can collaborate in the future, and I look forward to exploring that and seeing what we can do to help make each other better.
Yeah. Well, can't thank you enough for your time. This has been incredible. Thank you for being the very first person. I would say both to you and to anyone listening to look forward to some very exciting content, everything from interactive games that teach communication skills to video content. One of our policies is that every single thing that we produce is going to be made in three different styles. So we will have text, we will have audio, and we'll also have some sort of infographic to play to different people's learning styles. So please check us out. We're a few months away from launch, but speechscience.org is the website. And I just really appreciate your time. Ivan, do you have anything to add?
I just want to thank Mike for taking time out of his busy schedule to be in our first podcast here. I really appreciate everything that you're doing at ASHA to increase diversity, to increase membership, all of our conversations that we've had at ASHA and even after ASHA have been very enlightening and positive, and I look forward to our continued collaboration. So I'm very happy.
Yeah, this is great.
Thank you, Ivan, and thank you, Lucas. I really appreciate those comments, and I appreciated the opportunity to have the conversation with you, and wish you all the best with speech science. I hope it's a huge success for you, and from what I've seen you two accomplish so far, I have no doubt it's going to be.
Hey, that's very kind of you.
Well, thank you very much for listening. This is Lucas Stuber, the executive editor of speechscience.org. Thank you so much to Mike for coming and having this conversation with us today. We've been so curious about ASHA's recruitment efforts and what they've been doing over the course of the last several years. Obviously, not only as men, but also as minorities like Evan, like Chandru, and like many others in our group. So please stay tuned. Come to speechscience.org now if you'd like, and sign up to be notified when more content is available. We're going to have all kinds of stuff, from podcasts to videos to interactive games and lessons to resources, all of it absolutely free. We have a strong policy against advertising for this. We feel like there's been a lot of bad information that's sort of been out there that's been driven by profit. So this is really all about the science, and it's all about the kids or the adults that we serve. So thank you very much for your time, and I look forward to our next podcast when we actually interview an Iraqi linguist and SLP.